You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.
Today on our show, we're talking with Nancy Spector. She is the Deputy Director and Chief Curator of the Solomon Guggenheim Museum. She's organized multiple exhibitions there over her career, most notably Felix Gonzalez Torres and Matthew Barney's Cremaster Cycle, as well as a recent exhibit by Tino Segal and Maurizio Catalan. Nancy, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
I guess Tino Segal and Maurizio Catalan wasn't so recent, but for me, those are very powerful exhibits, so they've kind of resonated and stayed with me for a long time. But tell us a little bit about, to begin with, what is happening at the Guggenheim now for our listeners who are hearing this right about at the time we're talking.
Sure. Well, at the moment, we're installing a major futurism exhibition that will fill most of the museum, and it will be a historical survey of the movement with works, many works that have never been seen outside of Italy. So that is very exciting. We also have just opened a career retrospective of the African-American activist artist Carrie Mae Weems.
That's exciting, and I want to move backwards a bit, but mm-hmm. I'm intrigued by what has not been seen before in America from Italian futurism. Can you mention a few of those items, or is there anything in particular that stands out that we should be looking forward to seeing there that hasn't been seen before?
Well, of course, the most futurism exhibitions focus on the kind of heroic early stages, and this goes up through the early 30s with futurism's flirtation with fascism, which has been an area that I think a number of art historians have been reticent, at least in Italy, to explore. In terms of works not seen, we are able to borrow a suite of murals that were done for a post office in Palermo. They're literally being removed from the walls and brought here for exhibition, and they are example of late futurism and their engagement with aerodynamics. So they're paintings of airplanes, but from very, very dramatic perspectives.
Mm, I love that, and I think that is a very interesting perspective also to talk about fascism in that context, because now that you say that, that makes me wince a little bit, because I admire so many of the futurists, but of course that's true. Now I immediately comes to mind overtones of that in a number of writings we'd like to think isn't there, just like, you know, anti-Semitism in a lot of great writers.
Yes, of course. It's a good example. The curator of the exhibition is Vivian Green, and she's our senior curator of late 19th and early 20th century art, and herself half Italian, and it really took this, I would say, head on and wanted to problematize the history and bring that issue to the fore.
So let's move back a little bit. What was your beginnings in the art world? I mean, you've always seen so many exciting shows at the Guggenheim, which I do want to talk about, but I'm interested in what formed your artistic experience or interest in the arts. It could start at whatever age you want, either as a child or older, but What got you involved in the arts?
Well, it was a bit of a circuitous route. I started actually as a dancer, majoring in dance and philosophy at college, and always knew I wanted to be involved in culture in some form, but it was not meant to be. I was not going to be a professional dancer, and ended up going to graduate school and getting a master's and then a master's of philosophy in art history, and then actually got an internship at the Guggenheim. I would say I've practically grown up here. I left for a few years, but then returned in 1989. I got my first master's at the Clark Art Institute in Williamstown, and that's when Tom Krenz was the director of the Williams College Museum of Art, and he brought me back. So my professional career has really been here from the very beginning.
Wow. Tell me a little bit about you had a degree in, you said, philosophy and art history?
Philosophy and dance, my bachelor's mm-hmm. degree. And then art history, a master's, and then master's of philosophy. Just haven't written the dissertation in art history.
And did that involve the writings of Arthur Danto? Just because we spoke with him a little bit about him off the record before the interview, was that someone you were reading at the time?
Of course. I mean, I think everyone at some point reads Arthur Danto. When you're studying art history, you're reading everything from Wolfflin and the early German art historians, theorists such as like Panofsky, up through Rosalind Krauss, Annette Michelson, the October group. Certainly for me in the mid-80s when I was in graduate school, that writing was really, really important, certainly postmodernism and feminist theory, queer theory, I found to be incredibly influential. And my first exhibition that I worked on my own at the Guggenheim was of Félix González Torres, and that was in 1995. In many ways, I would say that I learned so much of my practice from him. The notion of intervention, of working within an existing institutional frame, Félix never shied away from wanting to occupy a place in the center as a Hispanic, gay, HIV-positive artist. It was very, very important for him to be considered, you know, on the same plane as, you know, anyone else we would feature in the Rotunda at the museum. But with this subtle intervention of content that could be considered incendiary, if you, of course, think mid-90s, culture wars, talking about homoerotic love, AIDS, health care, and such. So that, working with him, I would like to think, has informed many of my career choices since and the kinds of exhibitions I've tried to do.
And that was, you were working with him, that was the year before he died, is that correct?
Yeah.
I'd love to talk more about that. I saw that exhibit, and was that also, unless I'm just remembering incorrectly, Ross Bleckner was also in the museum at that time?
Yes, it was a really interesting moment. Then, you know, here I was quite young, untested curator, and proposed this exhibition. And I think that the director and the head curators at the time were a bit nervous about giving me the entire space. And at the same time, there was another proposal for Ross Bleckner's work and the decision to split the Rotunda, which is rarely successful. I can't even think of an occasion when we've been able to successfully divide up that space because it is so continuous. But the decision was made to split the museum. And in retrospect, I think it was a rather unfortunate choice. The pairing, both gay artists, both artists dealing with AIDS, came across as too heavy-handed. And I don't think either artist benefited from it.
Well, let's talk about Félix González Torres, because I remember that being just a gorgeous show. That was my real first introduction to him, had known of his work, but of course not nearly as much as I did after that show. And it was not just the huge piles of candy and the lights and the installation, but the fact that you could take things with you, the posters, right? That was, I remember, there was a stack of posters there, as there often is.
Many of them.
And you can take one, and I think the candy you could also take, right?
That was a fundamental aspect of the work, the candy spills and the paper stacks, that they are participatory and that they're, in essence, completed by the engagement of each viewer by eating the candies, taking a poster. And in many ways, it's interesting in retrospect because at the time of writing the catalog and working with Félix, I really saw him as a continuation of many of the ideas put forth in the late 70s, mid-80s, postmodernist, feminist theory. And I know he very much self-identified with that. That's what he studied. He was at the Whitney Independent Study Program. But years later, working on the exhibition, The Any Space Whatever, which looked at a generation of artists who emerged in the early 1990s, who were all deeply, deeply influenced by Félix. Their practice has been called, for better or worse, relational aesthetics, but this notion of the audience engagement and the audience responsibility to bring their own subjectivity to the work, to bring their own choice, if you will, to experiencing the work, to participating in the work, that I see Felix now, in retrospect, is very much the transitional or bridge artist. And again, so important for younger and increasingly younger generations. The work continues to be reinterpreted.
I think that's true. It certainly was the case for myself. I thought it was a gorgeous show and was very inspiring in terms of what you're saying, as it's now called relational aesthetics, maybe unfortunately, but it's such a broader field than that. And very, very powerful influence on a lot of artists. I'd like to hear more about how he formed your sense of curatorial practice. What was it like to work with him, and how did that expand your definition of of what it meant to put together a show, especially coming out of school? So this is, you've been at the Guggenheim for a little bit, but this is you've been at the Guggenheim for 6 years already, I think, when you did that show. But how did this change your perspective on what it meant to work with an artist or an artist like that?
Well, I'd like to say that my practice, and I hope that it resonates throughout the curatorial department at the Guggenheim, is that we are artist-centric, and that, you know, there's no other reason for us to do what we do without the artist. So this notion of facilitating an artist's vision is very important to me, and it's very important to us here. And I think that is apparent, I would hope, to our visitors who, you know, see most of our exhibitions. Working with Felix was remarkable because, of course, he was so generous with information and access to his thinking. And the book that I did was very much came out of a conversation. It is, you know, very personal in a way. In terms of what I took away from actually making the show, I think that I was able to begin to hone installation skills that, of course, one always learns every show. But I tend to allow for a lot of space, and Felix's work needs that, but I really, for the most part, unless there's some overriding reason to create a cluttered salon-style type of cacophonic installation, that work needs a lot of breathing room. And the Guggenheim, I think, really allows for that, obviously, because of the wonderful cross rotunda views one can have and the experience of moving through the ramps. But Felix always had when we would be deliberating over where to place something or if to place something, he would say to me, if in doubt, leave it out. And I've taken that to heart, and I often will work with artists and say, do you really think we need this much? Do we need to fill every square inch? Are we saying what we want to say? With perhaps, could we do that with less work? So that's really stuck with me. Obviously, not every artist is the same, but that's at least a guiding principle for me. And then if you recall, I don't know if you saw the Any Space Whatever exhibition with Pierre Huig and Philippe Perrano and Maurizio and seven others, Carsten Holler. There was a lot of emptiness in that exhibition. And it was very intentional, and in some ways it was very metaphoric, I think, for the fact that they were a group of artists who had collaborated intensely at different points in their career. But at this point, when we did the exhibition, they were pretty much exploring their own trajectories. And that emptiness, I think, came to stand for that. And I really embraced it. And it was tough. It was tough on our audience, I think. But I think it was an important statement to make.
I think so, too. That was a very powerful show. I did also see when working with Felix also, because I'd like to talk about other exhibitions after that, was there anything else that he said or his approach to your dialogue with him that was unusual or telling? I mean, the way you're using space and the way it was used in that exhibition was very beautiful. And I love that idea, because I think it is a tendency of artists almost, and perhaps curators, to want to put in more than is necessary. And I remember the curtain of lights in a room, which, as I remember, there was nothing else in that room. It could have easily been maybe something else somewhere, or depending on the lighting, it just makes it that much more powerful. When you say he was very generous, I guess, what do you mean by that?
Just very open about what he was reading, everything from October magazine writing to articles in the New York Times to, you know, a real passion for social reform. He really was an activist. As you know, he was part of group material that formed a great deal of his sensitivity, his sensibility. But also the freedom he gave to the curator and to the viewer to allow for open-ended interpretation. One thing we haven't mentioned is I also organized the American Pavilion of his work in the 2000, oh God, what year was it now, 7 or 8, Venice Biennale. And it was done posthumously, and it was interesting in many ways because I think he might have been the only artist, or if not the second artist, to not be living, to have their work presented at the Biennale. But I felt, two things. I knew that Felix had been nominated before by Anne Goldstein and Suzanne Goetz and Amata Cruz to do the American Pavilion when he was still alive, and he had even worked out a floor plan. So he was willing to do it. In fact, he was quite interested, again, with this idea of operating from the center. And so I felt comfortable nominating him, but I also knew that he was very generous with how people would make combinations, build different narratives from the different bodies of work that he created. And I knew at the time, this when I put in the application, Bush was still president, that I wanted to use the more political side of his work as a very strong comment on the, you know, state of the United States, our rather hostile presence abroad. The work that the Guggenheim owns is a big candy spill of black licorice called Untitled Public Opinion that Felix made during the first Gulf War. And the candies are shaped like missiles. And I know that was very important for him at the time, that the candy looked, you know, militaristic. And we filled one room of the pavilion with that, almost like an oil spill. So because of my working relationship with him, I felt confident enough to be able to make those combinations without his input, but also, again, having these other curators, having had that engagement with him. And in fact, they did a joint interview for the catalog about, you know, Felix's willingness to be part of this. And then Andrea Rosen, of course, who runs the estate and the foundation, was very helpful in the process, you know, more as an advisor.
It's very interesting how an artist's work like that can be mounted posthumously, and in that sense, that was a very exciting exhibition. And, you know, it was 2007 in the Venice Biennial.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes sense, of course, in the context of, as you're saying, his communication, generosity, and it's a wonderful way to also articulate how a curator and an artist can work together, and how a curator can also work independently of that artist.
Mm-hmm.
Because that was, I didn't see it in the Venice Biennial that year, but that sounds gorgeous, and it makes sense. And I think any artist, well, not any artist, but artists like him would be excited and honored to feel that the work could still be staged in a way that makes it feel like he is, you know, for lack of a better word, alive. I mean, these are
mm-hmm.
installations that look like the artist's hand is in there. And so very exciting. The next major exhibition that you did was Matthew Barney's Cremaster Cycle. Is that
mm-hmm.
correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which of course stylistically was incredibly different.
Right, and you took over the whole space, and now you have the whole rotunda.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember that as a kind of a blockbuster show. How did that come about, and how did that play out? How was that to work with in contrast to him?
Well, that it was a real leap of faith on the, for Tom Krenz and the chief curator at the time. I invited Matthew to make an exhibition on the Cremaster cycle after he finished the second Cremaster film when he won the Hugo Boss Prize in 1996. And then the show took place in 2002. So we had a luxurious amount of time to work on the project as it unfolded, which was incredibly exciting for me as a curator to actually, I wouldn't say be part of it, but to be a witness as each film evolved, the storyboards for the film, the sculptures, the photographs. And Matthew is based here in New York, so I was able to spend a great deal of time in the studio and then went on site to a number of the film shoots. And we really built the show over that amount of time together, although Matthew has an incredibly keen sense of installation and how he wanted the work all to come together. I asked him to make a show that would be both a culmination of the Cremaster cycle, but in many ways it became part of the Cremaster cycle, which was very exciting for us. The Cremaster 3 film, which was the last film made in the cycle, but of course it's the central theme because they were made out of order. The Guggenheim is featured prominently in it almost as a character. There's a dream sequence that then formed part of the installation, what we called the Jumbotron, which was the video, five-part video screen hanging from the rotunda. So the way he incorporated the building right into the narrative of the show was very exciting. And it, you know, marked the culmination of, you know, 12 years, I think, of work.
Amazing. Yeah, it was, and the reception of the public seemed, did that surprise you? As I remember, that show was kind of over the top. It was hard to get in at times. It seemed to, you know, if I'm remembering correctly, the catalogs were sold out at one point. You can correct me if I'm wrong there, but what was the audience reception like for that show, and why do you think it was as large as I remember it to be?
It's one of our most attended exhibitions. All records, of course, were broken by James Turrell, but it's up there in the top three or four, which was really exciting for me because Matthew was such a young artist at the time, and to be able to show that contemporary art can have such a following. I think the combination of, you know, Matthew kind of having a cult status in the art world at the time, the fact that many people had heard about the films, but it was difficult to see them, and the spectacle quality of it, which I'm very cautious about curatorially, but it is in the work. It's quite organic to it. I don't think Matthew can do work on a small, subtle scale, unless, of course, you saw the drawing show at the Morgan Library, which was exquisite. But that was a very different type of project. And what was very exciting for me every time I went out onto the ramps is that we had such a young crowd. And people were staying for hours. They would watch the videos. The people were lying down on the floor watching the videos on the monitors. We also had them running in our theater on a regular basis, so you could do a marathon viewing if you wanted of the five films. And just as an aside, I'm so excited because we just acquired we had all of the Cremaster videos and vitrines except for the very first one, Cremaster 4, and we were just able to acquire it as a partial gift, partial purchase from a private collector, and it was the last one available in the edition in private hands. So now we own all five, and we'll hopefully be showing them again in 2015. We'll be doing a collection exhibition.
Oh, that's very exciting. So people will be able to, in succession or at different times, watch them all? I mean,
yeah, we'll probably run them in the theater, but then maybe do some kind of configuration, which we've done with Matthew before, where you show the five vitrines and then five flat screens in some configuration. So you can't really watch the entire film that way, but you get a sense of the vocabulary.
And was that an unexpected audience reaction? I mean, it's true he had that big, he already had a following. Was it an unusual reaction, you think, to that show? Were you surprised by how many people were interested in it? I mean, the way people are hanging around, of course, is wonderful and a whole different use of the museum in a way, but were you surprised by the sheer numbers that came?
I wasn't, but maybe our board of trustees or, you know, Tom Rosencrantz had a lot of faith. He met a number of times with Matthew. He got it, certainly. So, no, I don't think so. I think that there's now, since then, been recognition that very contemporary shows can do well.
Mm. There's one question that I've always wanted to ask about him is, I've known a number of people that have visited his studio, and they've always said it was an enormously exciting studio to visit. Mm-hmm. Can you comment on that and explain, if that was the experience for you, why his studio in Manhattan is and was so exciting to visit?
Sure. Well, it's moved. You know, for years he was in the Meatpacking District. Now he's in Long Island City. He needed more space. Again, I had this kind of wonderfully privileged access because I was there all the time, so I could see every change. But there's just so many layers of information available. He works from storyboards, and when you visit, that's what he'll walk you through, the storyboard for the film. And those are usually found images, postcards, clippings, his own drawings. They're reproduced for the Cremaster series in the catalog, which is one reason the catalog is so large, because we decided we wanted to kind of really create facsimiles of those storyboards, because they're really works unto themselves. And they were, parts of them were in the Morgan Library show. So you have that, which gives you the narrative background. Then there's clips from the films in process. And the last, the Norman Mailer cycle, which the film is premiering next week or the week after at BAM, which is really exciting. There's footage from the live performances he did building up toward that you would see as a visitor. And then there's all this sculpture being made on site by a whole team of fantastic people, many of whom have been with him for years, who are real experts in materials that one wouldn't necessarily think of for sculpture, everything from Vaseline to new kinds of plastics to cast salt, and all, you know, that's just there recently, and it's quite remarkable what he's doing. And he has a show coming up at the Haus der Kunst in Munich that opens in March that is the culmination of this Mailer cycle, which will have all the sculpture in the film.
It's very interesting to hear just what happened in the studio, because that makes a lot of sense to me. And on the one hand, what the public doesn't often see and understand is the narrative and how the narrative is built within his videos. That's something that is hard to grasp initially. You get, as you were saying earlier, the language of what's happening, but the actual narrative is something that needs a little bit of decoding, or at least it is for me.
Mm-hmm.
And to see, to be told that narrative, and for that to be explained to you, you're kind of given a key or access to his whole process. And then the rest sounds like a little bit of a kind of wizard shop. All these sort of magical things are happening because, right, he's using materials in ways that haven't been used before. I mean, he's literally inventing and making new ideas. That does sound really exciting. I can imagine how people would be very excited about that. So there's a lot of exciting things coming up about him, and I'm glad you mentioned those, because those are important to see. The other show I wanted to talk about is Tino Segal.
Mm-hmm.
That's also a show that, for me personally, was very powerful, and I thought was a wonderful use of the museum in a number of ways. How did that show come about, and why did you choose to present his work that way? And he defies, you know, in a way, definition in so many ways. You know, it seems forced to say, well, you know, he's part of the relational aesthetics movement, which we mentioned earlier, but I'm sure he's seen in that context. But he seems that he's also doing something quite different. But there's certainly a relationship to Gonzalez Torres there, or it seems like that to me.
Well, he's deeply indebted to Felix's work and very much admits that and honors it publicly, which I didn't know when I started working with him, but it was certainly interesting to realize through the process. He was shortlisted for the Hugo Boss Prize, and I ended up writing the text to accompany in the publication that we do around the prize, and became increasingly interested in his work. One thread, I suppose, you could trace through my exhibition choices over the years is that I work with artists who tend to be engaged with some kind of performativity, live action or even, and participation. If you think with Felix, I never really thought of the work as performative at the time, but the discourse around it has really changed, and people are actually now writing about that very aspect of it. And then, of course, Matthew scaled the interior of the Guggenheim, and it was all about the documentation of the live performance. But here with Tino's work, it is nothing but, we don't use the word performance, he prefers not to, but engagement, live action, durational. And it was very fortuitous because I had wanted to make an exhibition that dealt with durational work, and it was our 50th anniversary, and we were trying to think about the year having an overall, an overarching theme that would really define what the Guggenheim is. So we had a Frank Lloyd Wright retrospective. So, of course, we are about architecture. We are about design. Even though we don't technically have a design department, we don't collect architecture, but we do build these amazing buildings. And, since then, with the BMW Guggenheim Lab, engaged in, real street-level discourse about urbanism. So we had that. Then we had the Kandinsky retrospective, which was modernism and art and the 20th century. And then the third project we decided had to be about innovation, about radicality, and that the Guggenheim is, in addition to looking back and honoring our legacy, that we're also always looking forward. And I proposed Tino because it was the most radical thing I could think of at the time, and the idea of we were celebrating the 50th anniversary, not of the founding of the museum, but of the building. So what better way to honor the building was to have nothing in it other than choreographed movement and conversation. So the building was a star unto itself. And I've always had the privilege of walking through when it's empty, and it's such a beautiful space. Obviously installed, it's beautiful, but empty, it's also a sculpture unto itself. So we invited Tino to make an exhibition, and he instantly thought of the work, This Progress, which he had shown before at the ICA in London, but in a very different configuration, just spatially very different. But he admitted to me that when he made the piece, he thought it would be perfect one day to stage it at the Guggenheim because it was the sequential movement upward through the spiral, talking about the idea of progress with different generations of interpreters, he calls them, volunteers. And I think it was a brilliant intervention, and so many people were so moved by the experience. We were all very concerned, obviously, that people would come and say, where are the paintings? Where's the sculpture? But most of the kind of exit polls, we ask people to fill out questionnaires, and we hear back very often from our visitors about their experience. And people were very, very moved. They really appreciated the level of engagement, how emotional it was for many people and intellectually challenging for many people. And for us, by working so closely with Tino and this core group of volunteers, well, they weren't volunteers, everyone actually is paid, formed this quite amazing community, which is actually still in touch with each other. They have a listserv. But we had retired professors and activist lawyers and choreographers and people who just really believed in the work, and it was thrilling to have this environment within the museum on a daily basis.
It's very, very exciting. There's a few things that I want to ask you about that. I mean, it's true that just the space of the museum as a sculpture itself, which seems almost how it was designed, was gorgeous then, and unlike a lot of artists who, are are working in performance, Marina, who had a show there, and many other
right.
people, it's
right.
still something else to actually engage every single individual that walks into that museum. It's not often that anything involving live action, in my memory and in my knowledge, actually involves individually engaging every single person, which is thrilling, really, and,
mm-hmm.
and kind of, you know, almost heroic in size in terms of accomplishment. One question I have is that always intrigued me was, I know part of this was also borrowing one of his pieces, and correct me if I'm wrong, that MoMA owned, which was called
right.
The Kiss, which was,
mm-hmm.
That seems also precedent setting in how it was loaned and negotiated, because I know
mm-hmm.
even for MoMA, how that was purchased was set a precedent. Can you talk a little bit about how that
sure,
worked?
Sure, of course. Well, just to your first point, which is such a good point, and something Tino talked about at length, was he really is interested in creating work for a mass audience, but that each individual can have a private experience. And I think that that's such a hugely sensitive approach, especially in this time of everything being so fast and quickly digested and internet-based, that we talked a great deal about that and all of the calibrations we went through figuring out our estimated visitorship and how many people we would need to have on the floor at any one time so that every person who wanted to participate could without having to wait in any exorbitant amount of time. So that was really a key part of the piece and of his work in general. The Kiss, which we did borrow from MoMA, and we did want to have really work that represented the poles of his practice. So the conversation-based This Progress, which we actually now own and went through a very similar process that MoMA did. The Kiss is more spectator-oriented. One watches it as they would a sculpture, but it moves, and it's durational. But for Tino's work, the idea is it operates much more like a sculpture or a painting. You arrive at the museum, and it's happening. You leave the museum, and it's still happening. It's not like with Marina's project, which I did in, again, I forget the year, the Seven Easy Pieces. There was a start time. There was an end time. People came to it like they would a normal theatrical presentation. The way one borrows his work or buys his work is because Tino's practice is inherently sustainable. The only energy and resources that are utilized basically is human energy. So movement, speech, conversation. And one acquires the work. It's editioned. I mean, he has managed to make a living, as he needs to and should, and there is a product, but so one does pay for it. But there's no paperwork. It's all done verbally, and there is a notary that we've had the conversation. The work cannot be documented by video or photography or any type of written notation. It really has to live in the memory of the caretakers, the curators, and the collectors who acquire it. And it's a challenge for sure because, of course, and I've pointed this out to Tino many times, the work is going to, by nature, change and evolve because memory is not sustainable in the same way. And that he's creating work that, in the end, is very anti-authoritative, which I find to be fascinating. And you know, he's a young artist, and he hasn't quite had to grapple with that yet, but it's built into the process. So it's fascinating. We periodically get together as a group, the people who worked on Tino's show, to rehearse our memory of how the piece was choreographed in the space. And, of course, Tino has people who work with him who will travel to any site that's going to produce his work to really choreograph it, set it up, cast it. So it's very, very different than any other type of acquisition.
That's something I didn't know. So now that the show is not up, hasn't been up for a long time, though the museum has acquired it now.
Mm-hmm.
You gather regularly on some regular basis as a curatorial team to talk about the piece and to kind of jog those memories and solidify those memories, because that
mm-hmm.
really is all the piece is, because you don't have directions written down for how that works. Is that
right.
correct?
That is correct. There's no script per se. There's a set, there is a initial question that's asked about progress, but then the rest just evolves depending on the speakers who are engaged in conversation. And there are, in the spiral, it is choreographed as to where people appear or not. There is a dramaturgy to it that we remember. But the beauty of our owning it, Tino has said that we can restage it on a much smaller scale. It doesn't have to be the whole museum. We could do it in the middle of a group show. We would obviously ask him, if we were going to do that, what the ideal situation would be. I don't think we would presume, you know, with our access to him, to just restage it ourselves. But the nice thing is we could make a much smaller version of it with far fewer people just to keep it going. And, you know, it's part of the collection, so it would be wonderful to be able to have a reincarnation of it.
It's such a wonderful way to think about art in terms of memory and also the intellectual engagement that show in particular brought about. I knew some of the people who were working with him at that time.
Oh, great.
As well as, you know, and their experience was wonderful working with him and in that whole process. What an exciting show to mount, and I'm so glad that you did that, because that I think was very meaningful to a lot of people, especially myself.
Thank you.
You know, I really did enjoy it. Is there something, it's been wonderful talking with you, in closing, is there something that you're working on or thinking about now for a future exhibition? You don't have to be specific if you don't want, but
sure.
Is there a way you're thinking or looking
at
something?
No. There are two shows that I'm really just getting off the ground right now. One is a Fischli and Weiss retrospective, the Swiss duo, who have not really been seen much in this country. Unfortunately, David Weiss passed away last year, but our conversation started years ago. So that's something that I'm working on. I may not be, in the end, the curator of the show, but I'm developing it. The Guggenheim's definitely doing it. And then I'm launching a kind of long-range historical research project on post-minimalism and trying to conduct a revisionist art history around it, because I feel that it's really been understood as a primarily American movement. Whitney did a wonderful exhibition called The New Sculpture in the early 90s. And, of course, by their mandate, they could only show American artists. But trying to look at process-based art, dematerialized work from the late 60s through the mid-70s, understanding maybe its performative roots and looking where subjectivity and issues of gender and such were certainly part of it. And I think that part of the history hasn't really been read. So I've formed a working group, a kind of scientific committee, if you will, and it's a project that will take about 4 to 5 years. And I've never done a historical exhibition, and very excited about it, and cautious, because it'll be new for me. But it's material that I've always been, you know, so attracted to and want to understand more fully. And then the only other project, as I mentioned, we're doing in 2015, a show at the Contemporary Collection I'm leading up a team of our curators, and it hopefully will be revelatory, because a lot of people don't know what we've been collecting, and we've been really active, and many, many young artists who will, you know, be shown in the Rotunda, so it's exciting.
That is exciting, and I look forward to that, because that's also where you said the cremaster cycle.
That might be the earliest. That might be the cutoff. So it would be, the first film is 94, but most works on view would be past 2000.
And one last question about the post minimal show. Is there brackets on that? Does that come up to the present, or is there
no? It would really be, you know, probably 67 through 74. I think tighter parameters are always better. It doesn't mean I might be involving some younger artists with whom I've been in dialogue with for many years who have been influenced by this period, who I would hope take a role in a creative sense with me. And I'm exploring that. Can't mention their names right now, but you could probably imagine who they might be.
Yeah, I could. And so let me ask you one more question about that without using their names.
Mm-hmm.
Exploring creative role with you means using contemporary artists to, you know, in an educational role or public.
It's so open at this point. Programming, catalog, installation, advice, really the gamut. Mm. As I said earlier, I owe everything here to the artists I've worked with, and I can continue to learn from them and want to continue those dialogues. You know, if I'm not making a show, I want to stay in conversation and with almost all of them, that is the case. And, you know, finding other ways to work with them is, you know, kind of ongoing. I wouldn't call it a challenge as much as just a very strong desire.
Nancy, thanks so much for talking with us today.
You're welcome.
You're listening to Yale Radio WIBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.